At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Survivor South Africa, Island of Secrets. I'm your host, Shannon Gates, here to talk about episode 13, The Season Marches On. And to talk about this episode, I have such a fun panel here to do that. First off, please welcome the Jacques to my maintained idol, because that is now his only duo, Mike Bloom. Mike, thanks for being here.
Of course, I have, in the occasion of this episode, went around and buttoned up all of my shirts around my house to the very top button. In honor of, I would say, what might be the ballsiest move we've seen in quite some time, but I would say the ballsiest move in International Survivor in the past, like, 4 days, by comparison.
I'm so glad you've buttoned up your shirt, because you were talking a lot about nudity last week, so I think all the listeners are, like, reassured to know what the clothing situation is at the moment, but I also want to welcome...
Well, yeah, in terms of the upper half, lower half is still a mystery.
Ugh, why? Just okay. Well, we haven't even introduced our guest, and I don't even know if she's still on the line now that this is what we're talking about. But if she is, I'm so happy to bring in an amazing, hilarious super fan who was such a standout on last year's season of Survivor South Africa. She is the one and only Jean Michel. Jean, thank you so much for being here.
Hi!
Thanks for still being on the line after Mike talked about his bottom half being a mystery.
Well, listen, yeah. She just used an Alaska greeting, so I think she knows what's up.
Yeah, listen, I have a very visual picture of Mike burnt into my brain right now. So we'll see if we can move past that. If not, bye.
All right. Shortest podcast ever. Well, Jean, it's been a hot second. You know, I think you and I had a lot of fun getting into a deep dive about your game last year. But I guess since that time, what has life been for you, since we were on the air last?
I mean, that whole journey after Survivor from, you know, it's such a stark reality check when you leave Survivor, you think, oh, that's it, I'm done. And then every episode that goes to air changes your view on how you've played. And with me specifically, I was sitting at the end there, so I knew that my game was solid, and everybody would come up to me in the streets going, you know, I'm really sorry that you're going to be leaving next week. And that just would never happen. And every episode it would change where I would think, oh, I've definitely won this. And then the next episode I'm like, oh, no, you have not. So that roller coaster ride, now looking back on it, I suffered massive anxiety. It is a shock to the system. You don't know how it's going to affect you watching yourself in that kind of game. And it was a roller coaster ride. I had the worst year of my life last year. After Survivor aired, I changed jobs, which was great. And right after that, I snapped my Achilles tendon twice in 3 months.
God.
And it was just, I promise you, I mean, I don't know how you believe in the universe and messages coming from somewhere, but I was being told something and I didn't know what it was. And it was some of the lowest moments I've ever had after Survivor came when the show was done. You know, I didn't win R1 million. I should have won and I didn't. And people tell me that still today. And yeah, it was hectic, but I've been struggling to watch Survivor up until this recent South African one. So I didn't watch New Zealand. I didn't watch Champions versus whoever. And I haven't watched any until now. And I started getting back into it now, watching South African Survivor, which I'm really happy about.
Yeah. Why was this the one that you felt that you could come back for? Because I would think, like, it being South Africa would be like almost more shocking having, you know, been out there.
I mean, I thought watching it would be triggering, which it is in some cases. And I remember watching the first one, and the moment they're on that, you know, the boats coming in on their three different tribes, your emotions sort of shoot through the ceiling, and you get taken right back there by watching it, other people living it. It's crazy. And I thought I was ready. It had been a year almost, you know, to the day that our first one went out. It was about a week or two difference. And I just thought I was ready. And it was South African, so everybody was looking to me and saying to me, oh, what do you think of the new season? And mm-hmm. I couldn't not support everybody from Afrikaans as well, who do an incredible job with this season. And I just thought it was too close to home not to get involved. And I'm glad that I did, and I'm glad I got past my anxieties. So yeah, I mean, when I saw the cast, I was like, well done, everybody. This looks incredible. I mean, Samoa, there's no part of me that goes, oh, I really want to go to Samoa and play Survivor, not remotely. So,
well, I'm so happy that, you know, I totally understand the emotions that you were going through. Happy to have you back. Also happy, Quinn, honestly, that you said 1 million rand at the top, because we did have someone in our Patreon group say how much they love the way you say 1 million rand. So unintentionally, so I think you sort of ticked that box for them right off the bat.
Million rand. Yeah, it's a sore point. I don't say it very often. Thank you very much. We're moving on.
Well, look, I mean, look, you didn't get to win the game, but you did then miss Survivor Edge of Extinction. So I think, like, you won in some capacity there. I was so glad that you did choose to watch and that you're coming on with us to talk about it. And there were so many things in this episode that it would be great to get your perspective. You know, obviously, there's been a lot of jury stuff. Obviously, there's been a lot of, like, this majority marching through, which you were part of last season, and some of the decisions that they've made. So we'd be really interested to get your thoughts more specifically. But in a broad sense, you know, beyond the triggering mental trauma of it all, how do you feel about the season itself?
I think so I look at it at two different ways. I look at it as if I were there, and I just mentioned it a few minutes ago that I wouldn't want to be with them because it looks incredibly tough. You know, small things like when they give somebody a raincoat as part of a reward, you know it's tough. Mm-hmm. The fact that they can't get their fire going, the fact that they've been dry maybe 2 minutes of a day throughout the whole season, I think one of the toughest things is their environment. If you watch the videos of people being voted out, Kubis just mentioned about it, the lack of being able to sleep properly. Their bug bites look like they are like really on drugs. So it looks like one of the toughest seasons they've had to go through. And if I look at the edits, I think that they've had to maybe persuade a lot of people not to quit outright and maybe have it go through a vote and people wanting to leave and asking to be voted for. There's some conspiracy theories around that. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to be where they are. With that said, I am 100% through the starting opening credits right until the end, 100% entertained. I am finding it, even some of the straightforward votes where we know who's going home, I'm finding, again, the great storytelling of the editors of the show, the great directing, the great casting, the people who are still there, for me, are intriguing. And yeah, I'm really, really enjoying the season.
Yeah, see, the interesting thing about this episode in particular is I know that we have talked about this essentially since, like, I don't know, episode 4 or 5, when people were saying, why are they doing this? Where they're editing in a way where after the immunity challenge, we pretty much know who's going home. This is the first time in a while that, I mean, I enjoy that storytelling style. I really like what they've been doing, but I was on the edge of my seat during this tribal council because I wasn't sure, you know, were Jacques and Kubis going to pull off that blind side with the loose change players, being able to do what Dante couldn't do. Oh my God, why did Jacques not play the idol? Now he's going home. What? Kubis went home. What the hell is going on here? So I will say that even though I personally have enjoyed the storytelling tendencies that have been a bit more unorthodox of the past series of episodes, I'd say this vote in particular really harkened back to that, you know, more US, AU, New Zealand based way of really setting up a big surprise at Tribal Council, where maybe we have to fill in some gaps instead of the show outright doing it for us.
Well, I'm glad that you've brought that up, Mike, because I have some gaps that I want to speculate on and fill in, because I haven't really seen this spoken about online. And I mean, admittedly, I haven't been on Reddit today, so maybe they're speaking about it on Reddit. But otherwise, I've seen a lot of questions of how did they screw up the split vote again? And, you know, last week, I think you and I decided You know, they just wanted Dante out more as human beings. They wanted their reward, so they chose Dante first. But this week, it seemed baffling, nonsensical that they would split the vote and have Jacques again be in the minority so that he didn't have to play his idol. And he didn't play his idol, and he gets to keep it. And I was dumbfounded, I have to say, for about 24 hours. I watched this. I had written all my notes to be like, I literally said last week I was going to stop making fun of the math of the show with Dante out, and now I have to make fun of it again. But here's my conspiracy theory. I think we missed a crucial piece of information, which is, as you said, weird for Survivor South Africa. And I think I understand why they made what seems like a baffling move.
Do tell. We are all ears here. I don't know, Jean, if you have any other conspiracy theories to compare. I don't know. Were you as baffled as I and most of the community is with how this vote turned out?
To be honest with you, I don't even think I noticed that it had changed. But, you know, for me, I kind of pay attention on the higher part of the entertainment of the episode, and the minutiae I leave to you guys to tell me what I missed. And with this one, there was a point in the edit where Rob was saying, okay, so I'm voting Jacques. And then I said to somebody, I turned to somebody because I watched it with a group of the same people we watched the previous season with as well. And I said to them, what's a bet he messes this up? And I didn't even notice actually that he hadn't done what he was supposed to. But I don't know, Shannon, what is your big conspiracy theory?
Okay, well, I'm going to get into the minutiae and the numbers, because right, it didn't make any sense. At every single point, we heard them say Jacques needed the most votes. I mean, Rob literally is the one to say this during the episode. At a point, they say that four women will be the ones, you know, voting for Jacques and three men for Corbis. Then they, at a point, Rob, Mike, Durrell, and Letitia say that they're going to be the group voting for Jacques. And it can't just be Rob who screwed up, because it's like pretty much no one did what they were meant to do, because it ended up being five votes for Corbis, two votes for Jacques, and then, you know, two votes for Steffi. So here is the smoking gun of what I have discovered, and that is in Steffi's voting confessional, she says that she has heard about the insurgency plan. She's heard that there's supposed to be a flip and that it's either going to be Corbis or her. So what I believe is that they went, obviously, to Maba and Darrell and to Mike, and someone who I would bet would be Mike came to them and told them about the plan, which we know through Steffi's voting confessional. They were worried that Maba and Darrell would flip, you know, because I think they seem to really trust Mike. So it could be Darrell, it could be Mike. I'm just going to assume Mike here because the numbers are the same. So they had to put four votes on Corbis, who they knew would be unprotected by an idol. And when I say four votes, I mean four votes without Maba and Darrell, which is what they do. There ends up being five votes on Corbis. So that just shows, you know, obviously Jacques is going here to flip the vote. But with the way the numbers ended up, with everyone switching their vote on the split vote, actually those four votes would not have worked out. So that's just the math of that. It would have been 4-4-1 or 4-4-0 if Jacques had played his idol, and they would have won on the re-vote. So I think while it seemed nonsensical, it might be correct or it might just be super paranoid, but it was definitely based, I think, on them hearing about this insurgency.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because I remember that Steffi voting confessional as well, and that definitely piqued my interest as to, you know, I could imagine, even though Corbis and Jacques were sort of, I mean, we'll talk about their sort of path over the course of this episode, where they sort of had like one foot in the alliance and then one foot out of it and realizing, oh, man, we really are at the bottom. I could imagine that, especially, I know you said, Mike, I personally think Darrell is someone who would have totally snitched on this plan to Rob, considering that, you know, we'll talk about the peanut gallery comments from the jury at Tribal Council, but they seem to underline the fact that Darrell has some loose lips. Maybe that's why he gets food all over his face, because his lips are just so loose and can't contain all the foodie stuffing in there. But you make some really interesting points that maybe they didn't necessarily want to see Corbis go, but if it was between him and Steffi, yeah, I guess that's the way to do it. I mean, unfortunately, that's a default plan, because I don't think it was a very good idea to get rid of him, especially in comparison to Jacques. But if they were really so spooked by the idol, which they were this episode, that Jacques was really able to take advantage of, then I guess it would make sense that this is sort of like a last resort. Though I do wonder then why the next time on did Steffi say she made a rookie mistake? What do you think that refers to?
Well, I would think that means that maybe she thought, you know what, they weren't ever going to flip and we were too paranoid. I mean, it's hard to analyze having not seen this and having it basically be my fan fiction. Although I will say fan fiction that I think kind of like stands up in the numbers, but I think that it's impossible for us to know if it actually was too paranoid, because it's like chicken or the egg. Did Maba and what was either Mike or Darrell not flip because they were never going to flip? Or did they not flip because they knew that the numbers had changed in the split and they literally would still lose the vote? And I mean, it's interesting you say Darrell. I thought Mike could just like look at his relationship with Steffi in this episode. Obviously, his relationship with Rob. We heard his thoughts about what he's planning, like, obviously, at the Seven. So, I mean, I thought, Mike, they both were voting for Corbis, so it would not really impact on how they actually put the numbers together for the split. But I definitely think one of them came back to them and that they were worried about a split, and they definitely would have been worried about two people flipping. So that's why I think one person came back to them and they're worried about the other two, because if just one person is flipping, if it's just Maba, they can still split the vote 3-3-3. But obviously if two people are flipping now, they actually only have 5-4. They have a slim majority and they actually can't split the vote. So while everyone's been calling them an idiot, and I certainly spent 24 hours calling them an idiot, I think there's actually some merit here to what the majority did. It's a cautious vote to make sure Steffi doesn't go. But if Steffi does go, it ruins a lot of people's games. Definitely Rob, definitely that Saula 3. So I actually see the logic.
I'm just surprised that people like Maba, who are clearly on the bottom and whose name has been thrown out so many times, and Mike is there protecting her. And this week it's like, you know, people are saying, don't vote Maba. Let's keep, you know, things strong. I'm surprised that she's not willing to take the shot, because what does she have to lose? She's not getting any further up any kind of alliance. So somebody like Maba for me is just frustrating me, because I keep wanting her to play. And in an episode like this, where she had a clear opportunity to do something about it, nothing happened.
I think I don't really blame Maba, though, because I think last week she seemed to want to work with Dante. This week, as I said, I just don't think that the numbers were there once they changed the split vote in other capacities it might have been. So whoever ran back to them, we can blame, you know, that person if it was Maba, but she's the person I obviously think is the least likely to have run back to the majority. And I think she wants to play, but I just think it's about having to find that person to play with, who unfortunately Maba has not had since Jeff left.
I mean, she has Mike, you know, Mike, and we see this on the previously on too, it really underlines the fact that Mike is specifically looking out for Maba. Maybe she doesn't want to burn that bridge. I totally agree with your point, John, that I think from our external perspective, you might sympathize with Jacques a bit in saying, well, she's playing a pretty passive game. She hasn't outwardly made any sort of bigger moves. But I do wonder if she's sort of subscribing to this Sandra Diaz-Twine motto of like, look, they're going to keep putting my name out there, but I just got to keep surviving until the next round. And hopefully subscribing to Mike's plan, if the numbers thin down enough, they'll either forget about me or I'll be able to actually swing and make a move. So I think that it is a little frustrating from an entertainment perspective to not watch this big swing happen, especially we're going to talk about the Steffi edit this episode. I was, you know, was surprised by the vote in a number of ways. One of them, because this really felt like a big setup for a Steffi downfall. And maybe it still is, but I do wonder if Maba's just sort of playing in the name of self-preservation and saying, all right, I'm just going to do what Mike tells me here. If Mike says that the plan is to split on Kubis and Jacques, let me do that for now in the hopes that eventually we'll have an opportunity to make a move down the road.
Yeah, she's like the other woman for Mike, unfortunately. Like, I do think he's looking out for her, but like in a more secretive way, where he's like married to Rob, you know, and he kind of has Maba on the side. So she's using that relationship, but it's a hard spot to be in. I was actually really impressed with her this episode. I mean, first of all, to go up against Rob for the advantage, we'll definitely talk more about the reward, but I just thought that was just so, I mean, like, she wasn't going to win, but like, I admire the balls. And
yeah, but I would also say, like, I love Nico, but it was kind of a douchey move to be like, if you would known you had been up against Rob, would you still have done it? I don't know. It
yeah,
felt
and she
like
was
a
like,
little,
yes, what a warrior.
Yeah, yeah, it felt a little judgy on Nico's part to be like, Rob is amazing. Why would you want to go up against this amazing person? You know, and maybe I'm projecting a little too much. I don't know, Jean, it was shades of the first immunity challenge that you won, the one with the big dragon puzzle. He essentially like counted you out until you came back and surprised him.
Yeah, actually, in the edit, you see it that way. But in the actual reality, he was cheering me on like he was my personal cheerleader. Oh. He would be like, Jean, you're still in this puzzle. And I was like, Nico, are you on drugs right now? Because I've seen people around half an hour earlier than me to the platform. They've had it so long to work on the puzzle, and he just kept going, and he just, I don't know if he knew something that I didn't, but for me, I think that was just an edit to play up how far I was behind in that challenge. But he was incredible. But I also did get that vibe where, and it's natural, though, I think it happens everywhere, where people look at Rob, and that's why I get so frustrated with the former Solo members is because they are so entitled that that's how they, you can just see that's how they move through the world. That people, you know, they look at them and they're like beautiful and godlike. And then you can just see that people, that stuff happens for them. You know, people do things for them. And that's how I've been so frustrated with the Solo members, because you can see Nicole is not really playing any kind of game at the moment. Steffi walks around and you mentioned in the previous podcast, Mike, where you were talking about how she's got this idea. And you were mentioning how she is looking at other people lying and then can call them out but can't see herself doing it. And she actually reminds me a little bit of Martinez and how he has a black and white vision of the world. And Steffi has that as well, where she sees you doing something wrong but can't see herself doing it as well. And I get so frustrated with the entitlement of those, the three now, where they expect people to play a game that's not the same as theirs, but they're going to call them out on things. I don't know. It's so frustrating to watch. I mean, watching a numbers majority move through the game, I can't really call that out because we did the same thing. But I do find that the players on that former Seoul, the people who are getting their way in reality, in real life, those are the kind of people who get their way in real life as well. So that frustrates me as an underdog. And all I'm doing is like, come on, Loose Change players, stand up and do something about it. And yeah, it happens. It happens in real life. So Nico calling out Maba and saying, you know, would you have done it? That's probably happens to her all the time.
I mean, the way that they have demonized Jacques for his idol, having been the ones to betray him originally with Sipe, is, I think, like, really just like a lesson in the tribalistic psychology of Survivor. It is crazy how, I think, you know, some might be gameplay, but some of it is in confessional. He is like public enemy number one for being, again, you know, the snake that he got rid of that reputation. Now he's back to being the snake, not for doing a lot, basically just for fighting for his life, which I think, you know, you're right, John. I guess it's like, why will you not lay down and die for us? I think that's what some people are being frustrated by, the fact that they don't think that Jacques has a right, you know, to fight for his life in the game as much as they would.
And Mike, you said all the time that notion that somebody deserves to be there over them. Or when Dante was winning challenges or reward challenges, and they were saying, we deserve to win. I'm sorry. If you deserve to win, then win. Because there's no such thing as deserve. The game is outwit, outlast, and outplay. But the most important one is outlast. You can't outplay or outwit if you don't outlast.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I mean, amen to all that. Steffi has such, I don't know, I am half between being really ticked off at Steffi once again this episode and also being like, it's very clear she's not winning. So I'm in it for the train wreck value of it all, because otherwise, I mean, her attitude this episode in particular, at least from an editing perspective, was pretty infuriating. Like you're mentioning, John, just the hypocrisy of her being like, you know, I'm all in it about trust and loyalty, and I'm all about sticking to your word, except I'm going to betray the 7 pact that I made a short time ago. That doesn't count. I'm still being I'm truthful and loyal. And I mean, also her mentality of going to the end with the Saula people. I know that she, at this point, I think she stands a pretty small chance of winning anyway, based on the jury reaction, but that might be the worst case scenario, to be quite honest, for Steffi. So it's sort of like her moralistic capabilities coupled with the fact that she has a pretty disastrous end game plan is just increasingly confounding to me. But like you said, Shaden, I honestly think it's an idea of like, you get indoctrinated with certain morals in the game, and that can really seep into your strategy, and that has really negative repercussions on other people around you.
I don't know why, but I had like a visceral reaction to her crying of laughter at that tribal council. Like, it infuriated me so badly. It was like nails on a chalkboard to me. I was like, nothing is funny. Have some decorum. Like, there's a difference between kind of being like jovial and kind of like having the funny analogies and literally just crying of laughter. No one else was laughing. You know, the jury are on the end rolling their eyes at her. Like, have some awareness for how you're coming across. She's just going to be basically put in her place, because now she thinks she could, I guess, win against Aulo, or thinks that's a good end game for her. And maybe she thinks she'll lose and she doesn't mind, but oh my God, I just wanted her to have some awareness. Why was she laughing? It annoyed me so much. And we're definitely going to talk about the jury, but Nicole as well is someone who I kind of had the realization last night that I didn't give her Chizzy points 2 episodes ago during the CPay boot, because I was like, But why did she say she would go to the end with Corbus and then not include him on the vote? And since then, she then also blindsided him, you know, last episode by not telling him about the votes that Jacques was getting. And then she voted him out. Why would you tell him you're going to go to the end and then she never worked with him? Like, I know that we chastise people for not, you know, jumping at opportunities when people present it to them strategically, and I agree with that. But it's not a fine line between that and I'm going to go to the end with you. She could have just said she was going to work with him. So you can see the way the jury is reacting to her. And I just feel like, what? She probably ruined something with Corbus where he might have voted for her, but now she's like promising the world and delivered absolutely nothing.
One of the things that frustrate me about Steffi as well is this notion that, and she called out Jacques and Corbus for playing to the jury. Have you ever watched an episode of Survivor that
no,
is the bottom
line? No, she definitely
hasn't.
So let me stop you right there.
Do you think that you're playing that you think that now that's bad strategy? Those are the only two people who seem to be doing that. They have got jury management on the top of their mind. Because let me tell you, I'm looking at the rest of the players in there and I'm thinking, you keep voting off people who, you know, could possibly not have voted the end. And you're putting them there and they're not going to vote for you. They're not thinking, okay, if I vote this person off, are they going to be an ally for me on the jury? Or is this definitely a vote against me, no matter who I sit next to? So Steffi, just her understanding of the game and her place and her social awareness is frightening. And Dante had it too. But Dante seemed, he didn't think of himself as this like high and mighty, you know, human being. But Steffi's got this idea that she's better than people. For what? I'm not sure why. Because you are a fit and you are a pageant queen. Where is your, you know, what are you basing that on? And that for me is frustrating. And I've chatted to Steffi on Instagram and she seems like a really good human being. I just think she's lost herself in the game. And it's one of the things you realize when you step out of the game is that you look at yourself playing and you're making these decisions and you're saying these things. And it's so heart-wrenching to watch yourself be mean and be a different person to who you actually are in the name of a game. You excuse all social niceties. You excuse just treating people with like decorum because you're playing in a game. And then you come out and you realize, hold on, the game is played with human beings. And I wasn't treating people like human beings anymore. And that for me might be very difficult for her to watch. I have the same feelings with Nicole and how she might be watching her game unfold and going, I'm a Mrs. South Africa, you know, and here I am just backstabbing and being this ice queen and not giving two hoots about anybody's story. And I think that watching that back might be very difficult for the two of them specifically.
Yeah, it's such an interesting, you know, watching the two of them, particularly the reactions to the jury, because I think that it's one thing to be high and mighty about yourself in confessionals. I mean, I think that's one thing we loved about Richard Hatch back in the day is because he was so braggadocious in his confessionals. But there's a difference between what you're telling us and what you're telling other people. Like, I think it's a really big death knell to her winning chances that Jacques really vocalized to us how high and mighty she was acting to them. You know, that's really bad. Because like you said, John, I think her attitude about the jury is just like, I think she sort of disregards them at this point. I don't know. My theory is that she is before this season, she was one of those people who would watch Survivor primarily for the challenges if she didn't watch Survivor. And then sort of just like, you know, yada, yada through the rest, maybe mentally speaking. Just because, I mean, on top of the idol stuff as well, my God, she was so demonizing of Jacques' style. She literally called it the devil at one point. You know, Jacques, they're suggesting all these plans, and but Steffi has to always butt in and be like, oh, but remember, Jacques, you have to use your idol this time. And, you know, to have her villainize that idol while being fully aware that two of her allies have idols that have not been disclosed to a lot of other people in the tribe, it's not direct hypocrisy, but I would say, you know, her having that knowledge and still being so expressive both in and out of confessional about getting rid of Jacques' idol because he's so sneaky, and if I don't trust you 10% then you're gone, it's very strange, especially since, again, Nicole got rid of Nathan and she's still like, you know what, you're cool, you're back in the cool kid club, but Jacques, nerd, you get out of here, I'm slamming your books on the ground, stuffing you in a locker.
Oh my God, it's so funny that you say that to me, because I literally felt this whole episode like she was trying to take his idol, like she was taking his lunch money, and I also think that's how she's going to try to get votes at the final tribal council.
It kind of reminds me of Tom's idea that if you lie to me first, it's okay to lie after that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, while we're talking about the idol, we haven't really even discussed, you know, besides talking about whether Mike is wearing pants, we haven't really discussed Jacques and his idol and the shirt buttoning, which was a baller move, I have to say. I don't think that it was the right move, technically, and I want to talk about that, but this was definitely like a main talking point of the episode. You know, he walks in there with his idol and he doesn't play it, which I think, Mike, you predicted a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm as surprised as you are. You know, I thought that Jacques Superfam would have pulled off the Russell Hans walking in with the idol around his neck and just the pure image of the idol being enough to really push people in the other direction to the point where he doesn't play it. I mean, see, you know, Malcolm did it, you know, before the Three Amigos Tribal Council, I believe he did it in the Philippines. So I feel like especially when you're playing with people who are of varying fandom statuses, you know, I feel like it really is just a big power play. And on top of that, you know, we found out that Jacques apparently left everything back at camp, including like his reward steal, which we'll certainly talk about in terms of weaponizing all his stuff. So I think he was really trying to put the idea in these people's heads of like, listen, might as well guaranteed safe this round. Mm-hmm. So you know what? Try to disregard me. And for the most part, he kind of was. Now, he did make some missteps. We'll talk about, you know, passive gate, I'm sure, soon enough. But I thought this was just, I mean, again, to coin us from another podcast we did this week, Shannon, these were whale balls. I think that Jacques, I totally understand that. I think him using the idol on Kubis could have been a way to really, you know, keep him in the game while simultaneously possibly getting rid of Steffi if the plan goes through. At the same time, it reminds me a bit of what Terry Dietz was doing in Survivor Exile Island, where there could have been a point where he like gave his idol to Austin or to Sally to use so they had another ally in the game. But I think at this point, Jacques is all too prepared to go into self-preservation mode and to be out on an island on his own. And so he thought, let me just guarantee myself another 3 days so I can get to this family visit and just lay eyes on my wife. And then I'll be able to go from there. But I can't necessarily guarantee myself another 3 days if I use the idol on somebody else. It was a huge gamble, but as a result, he's guaranteed to stay another episode, in my opinion. And it was a genuinely testicular move. That
why have you said testicular so many times on our podcast this week?
I don't know. It's on the brain. What can I say? But I do commend Jacques in just having the nerve to be able to do that, much like we commended our Australian Survivor blokes for doing a very similar thing this past week.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't begrudge him not playing it for Kubis because obviously, you know, you can walk in there like the Three Amigos, but if they have enough numbers to split, you might be voting yourself out of the game if you play it for Kubis, which he actually would have done because it was 5-2-2. He would have gone home on the revote. And if the flip is going to happen, you don't need to play your idol for anyone because hopefully, you know, you should win there just with the four plurality. So I don't begrudge him that, but I'm not going to credit him here. I don't think he played very well here. I mean, he is a brave man. Whale balls for sure. We've said balls now on this podcast and the recent podcast we did now like 50 times. And I guess that's just something that we're doing. So he is brave, of course, but it wasn't the right read. And, you know, in his voting confessional on the Mnet website, he votes for Steffi and he basically says either she's going home or he's going home as the dumbest player ever. But neither of those things happened. You know, I think he was hoping that either he was going to go, not hoping that, but he was thinking either he was going to go or the flip would happen. And yeah, as we said, neither of those things did happen. So there's a big difference for me between, you know, last week, say, kind of reading the room that they were going to vote for Dante because they wanted Dante out more and having the correct read and making the correct play not to play your idol. In this instance, he got very lucky and, you know, that they happened to change the vote and not vote for him. It's not a good read. Like, it was the wrong read. He didn't have the correct understanding of the situation. And I just think that he got exceptionally lucky. Like, if anything, we, you know, based on my fan fiction or what I feel is the real fiction, that they changed the plan based on his attempt at a flip. It seems like he trusted the wrong person, either Mike or Dorau. So that was wrong. And then that led him, the votes, you know, that led them to change the votes away from him. And then he played his idol in the hope that the flip for Steffi would come off. And that was wrong. And I basically feel like he fell ass backwards into this working out for him perfectly. There were a bunch of incorrect moves. I mean, I love the guy. Baller as hell to button your shirt up, but in terms of the strategy, I actually do not credit it.
You don't give credit at all to the fact that he was just so over the top about playing the idol. You have to imagine there's some theatrics in that.
I did at first give him more credit because I thought, when I was like, why on earth would they make this baffling split vote decision? I really changed my entire notes when I realized what I thought, why they changed the split vote. But I did, because, I mean, he couldn't have hit it the note harder. He wore the idol. Obviously, he talked about just wanting to get to the loved ones. As you said, kept his stuff back at the camp. And I was like, maybe they just assumed, as you said, Jacques was safe and Corbus was going home anyway, and they just played fast and loose with the numbers. But now that I think they actually changed it based on, you know, the exact science of who would flip and who wouldn't flip based on Jacques' plan, that might have helped a little, but I credit it less. And I mean, they were definitely scared that he would play it, and so they needed more points on Corbus, who was definitely going to be vulnerable. So that was helpful there. And I do think, you know, he's super brave not playing it, but his read of the situation was wrong. So that's my problem with it.
You know what I will bring in as well is that I will give Jacques a bit of credit, because he has got that monkey on his shoulder of where he played it incorrectly. And I think that he, you know, even down to the buttoning of his shirt, that would have been planned. He would have come in with that going, I'm not going to play this idol no matter what anybody says at tribal council, because they have tried to direct the conversation in ways to make me believe that I'm going to play the idol. And then he sits there through all of that and still in the back of his mind going, you've already screwed up one idol, don't screw it up again. And then he sits there all the way to the end. And I'm going to say that there are 9 people still in the game at this point. He is battling numbers. He's battling fatigue. He's battling hunger. He has got this loved one's steal, the loved one's challenge on his mind. He's got so much going on. The fact that he kept his cool enough to like play that baller move, that mafioso, like I'm the king right now. And he actually did it and didn't panic in the situation, I think took a lot of guts. And maybe he just had like a little blank moment at, you know, didn't think things through all the way. But considering what he would have been going through in that exact moment, yeah, I give him quite a bit of credit.
But the thing is, he should have been panicking like more than he was. Like, I mean, he was prepared to go home with it. And I guess like he put all his money, you know, on black, you know, he, whatever, you know, he was betting on his whole game on this. And he does say that he could go home as one of the dumbest people ever. And there is a different world where I really believe, I mean, I hope people buy into this, because I spend all day running the numbers, but I think there is a world where they don't find out about the flip and Jacques goes home right now, because I don't think he would have known that he was ratted out. He was obviously still voting for Steffi, still hoping the flip would happen. So I think that there's a different world in which he gets the majority of votes, which they've spoken about all day. He goes home with the out on his pocket and we think that he's an idiot, and I don't know how much he personally affected it. I do think that his extreme showboating did make them think that Corbus, as someone who was definitely vulnerable if they didn't have the numbers to split the vote because people were flipping, I definitely do think, you know, he was a much riskier choice as someone who they thought would probably use the idol. So that showboating, yes, but to not play it, there's a different world that he doesn't have that much control over where he is out the door, and I truly believe that.
Let me add some more fan fiction here. What if the information comes back to Jacques that someone had ratted out the plan?
Well, we've really just invented a universe. I love it.
Well, he might be hopeful still, not confessional, that like, oh, the flip didn't work, so I'm still going to throw a vote out just in case we get the numbers together. But I mean, maybe he got a sense from when he talked to Mike, who really pushed back against his idea. I would feel like if I was in that position, that's when my radar really goes off of like, well, not only is he not going along with it, but he might just out this plan to Rob, and then I'm basically screwed. Maybe it was a mentality where he thought like, okay, I know it's going to be either Kubis or Steffi. I'm going to vote along with Steffi just in case this happens. Who knows? Maybe they flip the vote on me, but let me, you know, maybe I think that the majority of votes are not coming my way either way, so I can sit safe with it, but it doesn't mean that I'm not going to make a big show about it. I mean,
no, but his voting confessional literally said, Steffi, it's either you or me. Like,
yeah,
I think
that Jacques is in the mentality that he has got this episode and, well, those 2 days and another 2 days maybe, and then he's going anyway. So I think he had his back up against the wall, and I think, I don't know where he's getting this idea that all of a sudden the loved one's challenge is going to be. I think that's talk up to tell them that he's here for, you know, he's playing all of his cards in the next couple of days. That loved one's challenge is not at least for top five. Because let me tell you, it takes four flights to get to Samoa, and it's about 40,000 rand for one person to get to Samoa. They are not flying eight people's loved ones out to Samoa.
Hey, John, this is a show that will give someone a car for a whole month, okay? They're ready to spend some money, okay?
They are not. I can tell you, because I'm part of the people who get invited to the press events, and normally they fly out a contingent of reporters to the islands. They flew out last year to the Philippines, probably six or seven. This year they took two. They were like, no, we are not flying you out. I can guarantee you that in the next episode or the following episode, Loved One Challenge is nowhere near.
Yeah, I wonder if Jacques was going more so off of the day numbers, and that's more of a U.S. thing, is that they usually do the Loved One Challenge around like the final eight or final seven, around like day 32 or so in the game. So he's sort of holding out for that. I do agree that, you know, I thought initially it would just be something that he would, you know, put out as sort of a narrative to everyone else, of sort of like what Mike was talking about with his, you know, throwing challenges of, you know, I don't really care about winning. I just want to make the family visit, guys, and then really turn on the afterburners once you get there. But correct me if I'm wrong, did he not say in a confessional this week as well to us? So that also makes me, I don't know, doubt things a little bit if emotions are clouding his game. And granted, I'm going to separate all of the baller idol stuff from the fact of him really ticking off people whose votes he would have needed for this flip with the whole passive players comment, which I felt like, I don't know, maybe that was also fueled by anger and fueled by frustration and fueled by emotion, but not a great play if you're trying to work with people that you're just accusing of playing passively.
Yeah, I wanted so badly to just kind of see through the voting confessionals if Marvin, Doral, or, you know, Mike might have been keen, but there wasn't a lot there. Doral was like, Clubus, I'll miss you around camp. I'm like, give me more, Doral. And Marvin did say that, you know, maybe she would have been keen, but it was just too late. So I don't know how much was him turning it off and how much was just, I mean, he and Clubus got blindsided the Sipe vote and then spent like one and most of the next episodes, like, really trying to work with this majority. They do come up with a plan eventually, but I just feel like it was really so late, which is the problem for me. And with Jacques, I mean, it's not just that we saw in confessional that he's talking about the loved one's visit. I mean, he chose to go for the letter over an advantage. And I've definitely spoken in other episodes how I don't begrudge people for, like, say, sitting out of a challenge for food. But it really does depend on where you sit in the game. I was shocked that Jacques and Clubus, who really
shocked.
Like, yes, okay, fine. So that's the hashtag for this week. But no, I was completely shocked and shocked that two people who are clearly on the outs and can basically take a hit too, especially for Jacques, their terrible reputations in the game, weren't going for an advantage and were going for a letter from home. Like, Jacques keeps talking about how he only wants to make it to, you know, to see his wife. I buy it because he keeps telling us that and because he played for the letter. And I'm like, dude, if you wanted to see your wife, you could have not left in the first place. Like, how can that be what you're playing for? I know that, you know, R1 million is less than $1 million, but I need him to have his eyes on the prize and less on his wife coming in a little bit more.
Listen, I'll tell you that narrative of people playing to a certain point in the game frustrated me, because in my season, I didn't change my narrative at all. It's so funny watching somebody like Sipe come in like amazing outfits for the jury. I didn't pack anything for the jury. I didn't have outfits for the jury. There was no point in my game that I was playing to be on the jury.
Well, that would have been interesting. I mean, I feel like you do need outfits for the jury, though.
Yeah, you would have bloomed it up on the jury.
No, bloomed it up is now what you've coined.
Give me my dodgy blue shirt. Ugh. Like, it's fascinating that somebody comes into the game with a mindset of not 100% throwing themselves in there to win. I mean, and we all know that I was terrible at the challenges, but there was not one point where I went into a challenge going, I'm not going to try my hardest to win this. And even when I was presented and there's the challenge where I say, oh, I'm going to win this and then I'm going to win Miss World or whatever, that one, I was given the option about 10 seconds before I let go of the rope to take chocolate. And Vanna next to me said, Johnny, this is not your challenge. You should go out and take the chocolate. And I couldn't let go. I couldn't give up. And for me, when I watch a player who's not invested right until the end, even if you know that Jacques can sit there and not win, I mean, if he takes Letitia, he wins. You know what I mean? There's so many options where Jacques wins this game. if he only makes it to the end. But he's not even playing to the end. I don't know. He frustrates me a little bit.
Yeah, it's shocking from Jacques as well, being the super fan. And like, look, if this was the US, Jacques would be like odds on favorite to win. What is he only at the final eight? He's got an idol. He'll probably find, if it was the US, another four idols. He's in good standing with the jury. He probably will win. But like, in South Africa, it might be a little harder, but the jury likes him. Like, he definitely has a shot. I don't know why he's focused so much on the loved ones challenge.
It's so interesting because I feel like while what he did was pretty offensive to people like Maba and Letitia, by essentially, I think he sort of did what he accused Steffi of doing by being like, yeah, you guys aren't necessarily playing, which again isn't probably my number two Survivor pet peeve, is people accusing others of not playing the game. But at the same time, almost inversely, it's endearing himself to the jury. Like, he has this super big underdog story. He's in the Rick Devens camp of making all these big spectacles and analogies at tribal council that, is really keeping them entertained. And I do wonder if, he is sort of calling out people in the way that the jury wanted to. I know we keep piping up. I'm sure we're going to get to the jury's reactions because this was the first time in the jury phase where we really saw their opinions at tribal council. But it really does seem like he's speaking almost on behalf of the jury, which, while it's pissing off the players that are in the game, if he's able to somehow make his way to the end, that's going to earn him major kudos with the people who are sitting on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, his plan with Kubas, to me, it was just so unfortunate. I mean, we know for a fact someone went back and ratted it out. And I mean, Kubas is saying that he might still vote with Saula to save face if Mike will go with it. Like, I don't think that this duo realized how desperate their situation was like 4 days ago when CPE went. And I think that that's to the power of the majority, that they kind of felt, at least Kubas, feel insulated enough that they really didn't try and create an insurgency until what seems like right before tribal council. And, with Dante, if they had tried to make an insurgency last week, I mean, Dante probably would have worked with anyone. We've said it before. It might have actually worked out, but I think, good on, I guess, Rob and his majority for making someone like Kubas and, I guess, at points, Jacques, feel like they could keep working with the majority when they'd been blindsided when CPE went home.
Yeah, I was so frustrated with Kubas as well, because we keep getting these hints that he is this mega fan, a super fan of the game. And he just, he had moments where it reminded me of when Tony... And I hate making analogies my season. It feels so like, whatever, like I had this groundbreaking season. But there were times when Kubas was talking and I was like, you're Tony right now. You've been played three times and you're still trying to go back to them, crawl back to them and say, guys, can we just vote with the Spit Shakers for one more vote? Like, at what point are you going to, fool me once, fool me twice? Like, oopsie, I made a mistake now.
Completely agree. It reminds me. This is going to be a very dark comparison, but do you guys know that poem, the like, first they came for the socialists and I did nothing, and then they came for the communists? Yeah. That's sort of like how Kubas and Jacques sort of played this round, right? They're like, first they came for Jeffrey and then I did nothing, and then they came for Dante and I did nothing, but then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. And so it's just a matter of, like you said, Shannon, I think somehow, despite being on this moral high ground sometimes, this Saula majority was able to really indoctrinate somebody like Kubas. And maybe that's sort of credit to Nicole, even though she does end up stabbing him in the back, into being like, no, you're with us. I know we made promises to other people, but you're really the one that's in the inner circle with us, to the point where they can definitely look back and, have made a number of moves that they realized they were truly on the outs. I mean, at least I give him some credit this episode for finally seeing the writing on the wall and coming up with a plan where were there not some loose lips and Mike was a bit less recalcitrant and didn't have his own plan going on, could have worked. But it's like Mama said in her voting confessional, I think it was unfortunately not too little too late, maybe a lot too late.
Yeah. And that really could have screwed him. I mean, it probably is credit to Nicole. I mean, that's, I guess, the other part of where I'm saying, well, why does she bring him so closely? I don't know if it needed to be that extreme, but definitely maybe that is why he's kind of still wanting to work with them, not trying to work on a different plan, which may have saved Saula. But I do think for Nicole personally, just watching another vote go to the jury, a jury that is already calling her nauseating, that I don't think is going to really be looking at her as someone that they can vote for. And we had a lot of questions, John. Obviously, you're someone who faced a jury. This jury is extremely vocal. What do you see when you're kind of looking at them giving such extreme reactions? How do you feel like that affects the game?
It's so frustrating for me because I see the TV side of it, right? I see that it's entertaining to watch them and to hear them and to, I mean, we get the subtitles, but when we had tribal council, we could hear word for word what they were saying from I could swear to God, I could hear an eye roll with them. It was palpable. And I like to think that I can read people and I can read situations, and socially, I'm quite aware of where I am socially and how people are reading me. And I often make myself the butt of the joke just to, like, you know, ease the tension in a room. But I was aware of that from the first time somebody was sitting on that jury seat. It was palpable. It was vocal. And that drove a lot of the decisions that I made in the game. And I found, and I look at it now and I'm like, you were so dumb to base, you know, taking Tom to final two on the fact that the jury hated him, that they were just sending these vibes out, and like not even just the vibe, they were sending the words out to us about how much they basically despised him. My decisions were based on what I was reading from the jury. And I really wish that either they were given the instruction to not make it as blatant, but then the TV side of it suffers, or that they were put a bit further away from the contestants so that they can't hear it, because that has an impact on the overall game of the decisions that you make. You know, the decisions that Jacques is, you know, making in tribal council, and what he's saying and the arguments he's putting forward. And I do think that you're on the money there, where he is playing to the jury, where he's talking about the weak players, because everybody in the jury thinks that they're not the weak players, that they were the ones who were there to play. And we had the same thing, although the people on the jury were just, I don't know. They do think more of their game, and they blame other people for being on the jury, and they don't look at their own decisions and how they got there. And so it is frustrating as a player to sit there and be given a narrative. And I followed that narrative. I mean, everybody hated Tom. The best decision would be to take Tom. And how did that not work out in my favor? It also meant that when I sat at the end, you know, the nice person inside of me, which is deep, deep down somewhere inside of me, decided to not kick Tom when he was down. Everybody hates him already. Why do I need to drag him? Why do I need to be that girl? Everybody despises him. And so somebody pointed out to me that I actually stopped playing the episode before the finale. I stopped playing when I made it to final two, and I'd stopped kicking, and I'd stopped my arguments, and I'd stopped everything. I just didn't have it mentally, physically, emotionally to keep going. And that was based a lot on the reaction of the jury. So it's big.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who analyzes the game, I feel like I'm seeing, like, look, if the jury are doing those things and the people in the game are trying to read it, like, that's a part of the game. You know, that's something else that they have to kind of factor in and read. I think where the issue is like, it's never been clearly defined what's allowed, you know? Like, it used to be like you couldn't say anything, and then the way the game's evolved, it's like now people can be so vocal. I mean, John, you didn't watch Edge of Extinction, but it was such a vocal, loud jury. And it's like, it didn't used to be like that. So I guess as fans, we just kind of want to know, like, where is the line? Because this is definitely a part of the game. And if the players have to read it and utilize it, we should know basically how much is being allowed to be showed to them from the jury.
First, yeah. I'll say, John, I don't think anyone, us included and anyone listening, begrudges you for what you did, because I'm sure 99% of the time we would have all done the exact same choice, even based on the jury reactions. But yeah, I think that the game of the jury has had such an interesting evolution from essentially the first time where Jeff Probst said the jury's merely here to observe.
And
you had them really sitting there silent. They were almost like, you know, people shadowing a class, where they're just meant to sit there. And now they sort of got to the point where they're shadowing the class, but they're participating in it, or they're giving reactions to what's being said. I mean, you have to wonder if, like, maybe it's a change in society, how social media has sort of burgeoned the running commentary that we do in response to random events, that it almost feels like you're living on Twitter when you're out there on the island. But yeah, I can't imagine how much it's affecting. And I wonder, you know, John, I know you can't speak to this specifically because you had the pleasure of not actually becoming a juror, but there was something in Dante's Ponderosa that I found super interesting, where Jeff was talking about, you know, how much he liked what Mike and Jock and Dante were doing. He said, because they're acknowledging us. And I think Meryl's like, do they not realize that we're the ones who have to vote for them in the end? And I wonder if, whether it's from these jury members in particular or jury members in general, if there's this mentality of like, we hold the cards at the end, so you should be regarding us more. You know, like, we're out of the game, but that doesn't mean you should completely ignore us. And again, from that perspective, that's why Jacques and Dante were doing such a better job at this and Kubis than someone like Steffi, who I think has this more so this mentality of these players are out of the game. We don't need to necessarily regard them. I feel like they're almost both right. But at the same time, if the jury has this attitude of we're still technically in the game, so you need to regard us, then that's why, A, they're so actively involved. I feel like this is a time where they can game every few days is in response to these. And B, why these people are so warmed over to them is because they're feeling, oh, they're talking to us. They acknowledge the fact that we're still in the game. This is great. I want to vote for them.
That only works, I think, if you're somebody like Steffi and you sit next to somebody on, you know, who is a Saola member. The fact that you're sitting next to somebody who made pretty much the same decisions you did, treated people the same way. But if you're sitting there with somebody like Mike, who has got so many connections on the other side and understands the jury, then you're at a massive disadvantage. Because I look at it now and I think these people keep sending, castaways who are not in their alliance, who don't have social relationship to the jury. If, for example, somebody like Steffi is in final two or three, wherever we go, who's going to stand up and fight for her? Not a single person on the jury so far, unless she sends some of her Saola members. And then you also have, okay, if you send somebody from your alliance, do they vote for you? Do they stand up and fight for you? Or are they bitter that they got voted out by you? Like, there's so much to weigh up. And the fact that somebody like Steffi calls out people for playing the jury, I'm like, wow, the fact that you're not thinking about that is incredible.
It's definitely a balancing act, but like Nicole and Steffi are like all the way on one end. Like they've ruined the balance. Like for most people, it's something that can be quite subtle, quite difficult to manage. But I feel like for both of them, it's just they're racing to the bottom of basically like who can get fewer votes between us if it's a final three and we're sitting next to basically anyone else. But Mike, I do love the idea that the jury is now a social media comment section, you know, something that didn't exist in 2000 and what is definitely the loudest place in the world. So it kind of makes sense that they're so vocal.
And, you know, some people like to acknowledge the comment section, some don't. And I think it just depends on like what the room is and how they respond to not essentially being acknowledged.
Yes,
basically,
exactly.
Do you even have an opinion if you don't share it?
Yes. Oh, it's so true. It's so true. It's like in 2019, I say this as I literally host a podcast, but everyone wants to feel like their opinion is valuable. And I literally just spent an hour sharing my fan fiction of something we didn't see in the episode. So I get it. I totally think that. And Jeff opinion. As well, in the Ponderosa, kind of makes a joke that is also a true joke, which is like, this is about me. I'm the juror. How much are you kind of, you know, talking about me? So that's definitely something I think the jurors wanted. Maybe in the early days of Survivor, they were fine for it to be about you. Like, you're still in the game, you're the star, and I'm voting for you. And maybe we're talking about society at large now. The other jurors are like, it's not about you. Like, it's still about me. We're the Instagram generation. Like, it's not about me yet. I think that's really interesting. I think there is something there.
Yeah, and I think that's, let's I guess, sum up what the jury or some jurors think about the castaways just based on what we've seen. So as we mentioned, Nicole and Steffi did not get good reactions. I'd say if we're ranking these four jurors based on how emotive they were, Jeff's by far number one. I'd put Meryl number two, Dante number three, and CPay number four. CPay, outside of giving Jacques a thumbs up,
which
really
I love.
Didn't.
Had a, it's my new lock screen. It was so cute.
Pretty much had like only a poker face on this entire tribal council. Dante, you had him, and I will say, you know, I had put out that barb of, God, I hope that Rob, if he makes it to Final Tribal, voices his own game properly. We saw this week that while Dante rolled his eyes at Rob still going under this idea of, well, Dante was the one that was stealing food from us, so we had to get rid of him. Kubis did say in his exit interview that he might be voting for him if he makes it to the end just because he's that powerful of a player. So maybe that's a bit of a wash. But yeah, Nicole and Steffi, it really seemed like the statements from what they were making really earned eye rolls from them. I think Meryl literally said, "That's funny, yo," in a response to one of Nicole's statements. Another thing I found interesting is the always enigmatic Durow. You know, Jeff, I theorized that, you know, Durow was just so amiable that he could have, you know, done well socially to the jury. But Jeff said something about his loose lips. So maybe that snitching has put him in bad reputation with the rest of the jury.
But in a loving way, like classic Durow with his loose lips, the little cutie.
It's so interesting during the reward challenge, which I'm sure we'll get back to, but like we see Mike's logic and when he threw the letters to Steffi. We have no idea why Durow threw the food to Nicole. No, absolutely no clue. And this is Durow. He loves snacking. Why did Durow do this and did it so blatantly? I have absolutely no idea, but that is part of the mystery that is Durow, and I absolutely love it.
Listen, I do have to I have to tell you that I met somebody who met Durow in person recently.
Oh my God.
I went to lunch with friends yesterday, and one of the friends said to me, "Oh, I met somebody from Survivor," and I said, "Who was it?" She said, "It was Durow." I was like, "Oh my God, is he airhead?" And she said, "Oh my God, he's so sweet, but he is a ditz." And I'm like, "Yes,
a real life doof."
I can't believe we're talking to someone who talked to someone who knows Durow. Like, this is just, like, completely starstruck moment for me.
Yeah.
But someone that does definitely have a good thing with the jury right now, and someone who was a big part of this episode, was Mike. And, look, we got to hear what his plans are. Last week I said I think that he's either going to go to the end with Saula and take Rob out towards the end with everyone and hope Saula get on board, you know, like Verna style, like what you guys did, or try to take him out. And I even think I said a seven with Lao Mei. So, you know, Mike, you called Jacques wearing the idol. I'm calling this. It won't work out now because Jacques is not going home next week unless they vote for him again and he doesn't play his idol. But yeah, I don't know how I feel about this plan. I want to say about Mike, his social game is so good, and it's the kind of thing where it's really hard sometimes to see a social game the way we can analyze, like, obvious strategic moves. But for him, I can see it. Like, I can feel that social game through the screen, the way he obviously gave up the letter from home to Steffi. Just the way he interacts with everyone, it's not surprising to me that he's approached for every plan. I think he has A-grade social game. But seven, even though I said it last week, now I'm thinking about it. If he could switch, which was his plan, to switch at seven with Lao Mei and vote out someone there, that'd have to be an excellent move. And I'd be happy for him. I'd be happy to credit him if he does it, you know, maybe, you know, go with Jacques, maybe make the move earlier next week or have to vote someone out next week and split the votes on Jacques and then use Jacques in the new four. If he can do it, I'll be impressed, because you're doing it against the Saula three. Three people likely to win a challenge, two idols between them. It's not a lot of time. I do think he would win next to anyone, but Saula don't want to go to the end with him, so he has to break up that three. He's leaving it very late. Mike, do you think seven is too late for him to go with the plan?
I am very nervous about the fact that we saw this plan and that we saw it so early, because
so
I feel
Africa,
like...
Though.
That's true. Well, granted, Survivor South Africa does unorthodox, you know, editing, but I feel like usually in Survivor, when we see someone say, "This is my grand plan," 90% of the time, that plan is not going to work out, right? Because we want to be surprised. We want to see, oh my goodness, Mike suddenly made this move. So, I mean, I think it makes logical sense. You know, we talk all the time about how Survivor moves come down to timing and how, as much as we're sitting on our couches saying, "No, you got to make the move now," it's clear that he had a very, just like Jacques had a rigid picture of him seeing his wife, Mike had a rigid picture of him making this move at the final seven, to the point where he was spreading this information at the final nine, which was a little dicey because that might come back to him at the final eight or even the final seven as well. I mean, I'm hopeful it goes through because, you know, we've been waiting for Mike's big move and this is something that he could really do. But part of me is just really nervous that because we saw this, that it's not going to happen. But on the note of the social game, I thought it was so interesting how he has this, you know, very minute breakdown about not having the letter. But he said the lesson that he learned from the game is when you can be kind, you must be kind because there are lots of horrible things going on underneath the surface. And it's so interesting, especially, Jean, when you were vocalizing before about sort of keeping your head in the game and maybe not realizing the weight of the words that you said. It seems like Mike just really has this attitude of like, I'm going to be kind to as many people as I can, because there's so many other duplicitous things that can be happening in this game. And that is probably the most simple, boiled down explanation I've ever heard of a social game in the game of Survivor. Yet it's just so poignant to me and so simple.
Yeah, they're you can see that Mike is genuinely a really, really decent human. And he's also one of these massive fans of the game. So he's seen people do, you know, Survivor type things. And yet he's still able to keep his humanity when he is doing dodgy things. I mean, remember a couple episodes ago when he was trying to convince Jacques to play his idol, you could see that he was like, you know, it's come to my attention that your name might for, you know, use it, don't use it. He's not like trying to bully people. He's trying to subtly, as human as he can, manipulate somebody into making a decision that suits his gameplay. But I mean, the loved ones' letters, let me just tell you as well, it is the first time that you see the cruelty that can be this game. And for Mike to give up, I don't know if he realized if it was that big of a decision that he was going to let Nicole win because Steffi win because he wanted to do this nice thing for her. Or if it was a case of, oh, I'm not going to win this. I should let it go and create this big moment of me giving it up because I'm definitely not going to outbeat her. You know what I mean? There was that. Mm-hmm. There's this moment where he has to weigh up. Am I going to win this or do I give it up and look like a hero? But the fact that he comes back to the beach and Mike, you say he has a little wobble. That is an ugly cry. He had a moment where he second guessed every decision he's made. Why did he come onto the show? That's what goes through his mind when he's sitting on the beach there having an ugly cry. He's filthy, dirty. He's hungry. All he wants is that letter, which let me tell you, when you get it, it screws you up like you have no idea. So, you know, Steffi gets her letter. It looked like a novel to me. And that is going to have an impact on her game. And it's sort of, I remember Annalise had such a great analogy of how she played the game. She put everything that was emotional, her family, her kids, her husband, her business, into this box in her mind. And she'd never let the lid come up. She never let herself go into the box to talk about her family. You know, that we would have lighthearted conversations. And every now and again, she would say to me, Johnny, the box, the lid is slipping. And I would be like, don't worry, your kids are fine. They're fine at home. They're eating pizza with their dad. And then she would go back into the game mode. But those letters, the fact that they're sitting there, you can see them and somebody else got them. It is a mental stab to the temple. It's hectic. And it's the first time you realize how cruel the game can be. And for us, it happened a bit later on in the game. For them, they still have a lot of game to play. And now that's there. You know what I mean?
Right. And I'm trying to remember also, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, because I think that the first time the letters appeared was during the infamous Shanae Boot episode when like her and Palesa and Tony and Werner like got their letters randomly in a reward. Right. So what was your reaction to when you found out after the fact of like, hey, we didn't just get hot dogs. We ended up getting our loved ones letters, considering the emotional weight that you just talked about.
I mean, for me, it was never an issue. Again, I was playing till the end when I saw and she was my best friend. She wasn't. And I speak about the minutiae things you don't think about, like how easy it was for me to be in that game. And my low point came 5 days to the end. That was when I hit rock bottom. But some people were hitting rock bottom day three. You know, the moms, the wives, the husbands, that downfall. And I almost want you to picture it as a graph. Their low hits quick. Mine hit right near the end. I didn't have responsibilities and people who were relying on me and a business and children who, you know, are without their mom and couldn't tell anybody where their mom was. Those small things make a huge impact on your game. And when you let the lid lift, as happens with the letters, it's sort of, you forget where you are. You forget you have this game. And for me, I knew that my letter wouldn't be this emotional thing because my mom was like, I'm not an emotional human. I am not I don't have feelings and I'm not going to come visit you because I don't want to be on TV. I think she also had in the back of her mind that she didn't want me to lose a challenge because she was there, because we've watched so much Survivor together. She's seen loved ones have to do the challenge. There's that part of her going, I don't want Jean to tank her game because I can't throw a ball in a hoop or something like that. But if she knew how bad of the challenges I were, you know, I might have had an advantage having my mom there. But I know that my loved one wasn't as sentimental. She's my best friend, the person that I was living with. Like, she is a great human being in my life, but she wasn't my person. And by having a person in the game, it's hectic. And I knew that my letter wouldn't have had as much emotional impact on me as it would have on the others. Mine was half a page. Your cat's fine. Everybody at work.
You should have the cat there as your loved one. Then it lives all the way off there, right?
Yeah, so for me, it was a completely different journey. But the fact that people, you know, every morning when they get up, they read that letter again, they go into a space that isn't actually healthy for the game, because you remove yourself while you're reading a letter, something else is happening over there. So the impact of those letters and those loved ones, it's a fascinating thing to watch. And the fact that it's happened, you know, at 9 is hectic. And now that's playing there, you know, because the people who didn't get their letters are thinking, at the next one, do I get my letter? At the next challenge, am I going to get my letter? When do I get my letter? And for me, that wasn't a thing, because I knew, I literally said to everybody on the island, I was like, this is what my letter is going to say. It's going to be, ha, here's your cat, ha, ha. You know, I knew exactly what to come because I knew the people in my life. We're not like emotional, lovey-dovey human beings and gush and you know, but if you're a mom and you get a message from your child, that affects you badly.
I refuse to think that getting a message and photos of your cat is any less important than a mom getting letters from their kids. Like, honestly, like, that's the one thing I begrudge some of these people for sitting out for letters from their loved ones. But if it was like advantage, food, and letter from your pet, I'd be like, they should really all take the letter from their pet. So I feel like the pet thing's its own thing.
Listen, my cat's name Rabbit, and had I got a message from Rabbit, I would have walked off the game and been like, it's a miracle, she wrote me a letter and she's amazing. But yeah, I get, you know what I mean, it's a completely different vibe. My cat also, Shannon, let's be honest, the cat be like, you want me to write what now?
Yeah, my cat would be like, I'm glad that you've been gone and that's what my letter is to you. But no, I mean my cat hates me. Follow evilcat_melody. No, she loves me, she's the best. I want, Mike did a powerful thing, as you say, and like, he's a good soul. Like, you can just tell, I mean, the head on his shoulders, he's years younger than anyone else on the show. And it really, you can't tell. Like, I think he's handled himself.
No, he's very emotionally intelligent.
Yeah. And he handles himself, I think, so well. Like you said, Mike, I mean, when he said that thing, which was basically just like, be nice. I was like, damn it. I talk about this show for hours every week. And you just summed up like 95% of it, you know? And a lot of these people, especially this week, as you said, can get caught up in the show. And I think just be nice is a very, very good message. But I do want to talk a little bit about this reward, because as you say, Jean, I mean, those letters from home are a powerful thing, a complex thing. It was up against food and then also obviously an advantage. This is taken from Survivor Co. Wrong, where only two people went for the advantage. Only two people went for the letters. I personally thought everyone would be going for the advantage and the letters would kind of be left behind. I mean, I definitely thought Jacques, Courbis, Rob, who did end up going for it, someone like Nicole as well. I mean, these people are playing hard. I was surprised that it broke down the way that it did. Were you surprised by this, Mike?
Very. I mean, considering how much Nicole, even though she won the food, lamented that she gave up a letter for food. It's just so interesting to me. That's why I'm very excited for, hopefully we can do some deep dives with these people to really get in their heads as to why. I mean, listen,
they wanted to hear about their cats, Mike. Listen up.
Or their dogs. Hashtag dog people. But listen, I was very excited for this challenge because, as you know, I love me some choices on Survivor, and this was one that really boiled down to choice. You know, I do wonder, maybe to Nico's question, if there was like a little bit of gamesmanship involved, if like, if one person had to raise their hand first to volunteer, like how much does that influence the decision that you make? But yeah, it was very interesting, especially considering how, you know, Kubis and Jacques knew they were on the out, Sanaka for the advantage. Shades of, from your own season, John, PK not going for the advantage at the auction, despite Despite knowing he was on the bottom. I mean, I guess maybe that just speaks to the emotional weight that comes with those letters and how much Jacques has really thrown himself behind this whole idea of his wife visiting. But you'd have to feel that, like, if you have a split second and you see how the numbers are working out from a chance perspective, and also, I guess, from a long-term game instead of a short-term game perspective, the advantage would ideally be the way to go, considering that what Rob got was essentially what Luke got in that Australian Survivor 2017 auction, which was a little bit of everything.
Yeah. And I liked it because that, like, rewarded the people who went for the strategic thing. I mean, like, look, not that it can be a bad thing to go for food or a loved one's letter, depending on your position. I think it was really, really bad from Jacques and Courbis. But yeah, I mean, it said, look, you were good enough to win in a category that you would think would have had the most people, and you gave up love and food to have it. Well, here's an advantage and love and food. I thought that was actually really good.
Like, hands down, I would have gone for the advantage, even knowing how terrible I was at challenges. I would have gone for the advantage any time. And it's the same thing when, if given the option to sit out a challenge, knowing how terrible I am at them, I would still try. And that's because my headspace 100% from the moment I got on to the show, not even the moment I got onto the beach, from the moment I got onto the show, was always to sit at the end and to give 100% of everything inside of me to win at all costs. And by getting little advantage over a letter was going to get me there. And one of the things that Zaningi said to me, my flatmate said to me on the loved ones reward, she said, you didn't come here to win challenges. And I was like, oh, I forgot that. Mm-hmm. And that would have been my decision, hands down, quick and easy. I would have said, give me the advantage.
Speaking of Rob, I feel like we have not addressed really the elephant in the room in terms of a lot of the questions that we've gotten in response to you coming on, because we've definitely spoken about the Rob Werner comparisons and whether or not they would face the same trajectory. But John, I guess as someone who served as the right hand of the bus builder for a good amount of the game last
the
season,
car.
I mean, do you see any comparisons personally between either the way the two are playing the game or the way they are personally?
I think that Vanna is more of a strategic player. I think Rob came in thinking that he was going to dominate physically. And one of the things that I know that Vanna tried not to do at the start was to dominate physically. In your team, your tribe challenges at the start, he tried to take a back seat. He didn't want to stand up and be the leader immediately. Whereas Rob took on that, I'm the king of this tribe, I'm here to dominate physically. And I think when he realized, whoa, this is actually not a physical game, he had to change. And I think he's, at first, I didn't really rate his game. I was like, yeah, you've got this huge numbers majority, you're treating people really badly, I'm not sure how you're going to win this game, even if you do. But my view of Rob changed with the CPay vote. And it wasn't even the vote to get out CPay, it was the subtle manipulation of CPay to give him the other part of the idol that for me said, okay, now I can recognize that you're playing the game on a number of different levels. But the fact that he has so much control over other people, and we all talk about drinking the Kool-Aid because that's what I feel like people are doing with Rob. I would too. If that guy looked at me with those eyes and just he's got some charm about him, I would also be in Team Rob. But for me, does he see? I think with Werner, he was able to see that he was a big target and that people were going to turn on him and it was just a matter of time. And I think with Werner, it was a lot later than he anticipated it to be. I don't know if Rob is almost game aware that he is going to be a target imminently. And I don't know what he's doing to counteract that. He's got so many fingers in so many pies that he's promised so many people, final two. And if any of those people say, hey, Durrell, what did Rob promise you? Mike, he promised me this, and figure out that everybody's been promised the same thing. It's just a matter of time for it until he goes. And I think that he is a strong player and he is the leader and the biggest strategic threat and social threat at maybe not strategic threat, but social threat at the moment. But I think that Vanner he was more aware of where he stood and his shortfall. I think Rob isn't aware of his shortfall the way that Vanner was.
Yeah. I mean, he did consolidate part of his numbers again this week, even though we did hear Mike talk about wanting to come from him, which is not something that we'd really heard from anyone with real influence in the game. I mean, certainly Dante over and over, but Mike really does have this plan. It's a difficult plan, as I've said. He's going to have to blindside him with an idol, or at least blindside Nicole with an idol and split the votes on the next one. Rob can obviously win challenges, and Mike is relying at Final 7 on Drow, who's, you know, Rob's little helper, and Letitia, who we still have no idea really where she stands. So he's really got some numbers in his favor. We heard as well Steffi say she you know, doesn't want to flip on Saula. I think he's got a lot of power. I could still see it coming against him, but it's going to be tough. And as it gets closer, that power, I think, does kind of grow. And we did see him this week say that, you know, he wants to try and protect against a blindside. So it's something he's going to do. Is lie about, you know, obviously lie about what he got on Island of Secrets and not actually tell what would have been actually a pretty fine thing to tell everyone, I think, considering it was episodic. But he's going to say that he can know two people's votes at one of the next three tribal councils. And, like, I love pretty much everything Rob is doing. I don't really know if this is necessary. Like, first, it's hard to tell based on the writing. And also, is anyone not making a move because they're scared their vote will be found out? Like, you don't know whose vote Nico is showing. And I feel like hidden votes are so rare. Like, I don't know if this is what is actually, like, influencing strategy.
This is also, it's such a weird twist, because I know we've never seen it on, you know, American, Australian, Survivor, etc. Maybe one of the other international editions did it at some point, much like the black vote, I think, from, like, Israeli Survivor. But, like, what is it going to do? Is, like, a producer going to whisper in his ear, like, okay, so Drow voted for Kubis, and Jacques voted for Steffi.
Like, it comes from, like, the social games. Like, it's the kind of thing where, like, in Werewolf, you can see, you know, the seer can see who the werewolves are. And stuff. Like, it's a game thing.
He's the secret
police. They hand
police.
Out an invisibility cloak before, you know.
He's the Survivor secret police, essentially. He's like, okay, are you a part of the mafia? No? Okay, great. Now I can go back to sleep. It's a little too fan fiction-y from my perspective, but considering this is a season where we're not one but two people have come up with the exact same lie that they were given a choice to call their dad or call their family on Island of Secrets, which Rob didn't get to call his dad, but he got a letter from his dad, which, Rob, listen, as someone who has atrocious handwriting, your father's handwriting is not poor.
It was so good. It shamed me so
bad. Do not throw him under the bus.
I have the worst handwriting, and I was like, that is not that bad. Like, how are you shaming me right now?
I want to know.
Yeah.
Are you know, is your handwriting as good looking as you? Because if it isn't, we're going to have a conversation.
Okay, Rob, please send us a sample of your hand. Actually, we could probably just look at his votes. I mean, his handwriting must be calligraphy.
Yeah, he's very like Eric Reichenbach in terms of his drawings. Also, Shannon, don't disparage Letitia too much. We did find out her primary, you know, motto of strategy this episode.
To be active, running around like a bush baby to impress anybody.
So yeah, no bush baby.
Okay,
leave her alone. She is my favorite.
I love her too, Jean. She reminds me of my grandma, and I love my grandma.
Yep. We call her Tani Letitia, which is a label of respect for an older woman in South Africa. You call her Tani, which is Afrikaans for auntie. And she's the only person I will call Tani Letitia. And she's definitely going top five, 100%.
Mm. Ooh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I've been sort of beating that drum for a week to this point of like, who's going to use the vote on Letitia? And I don't know. I totally agree that I think she's absolutely making Jacques' gated family visit. And then we'll see where she goes from there. I want to go back to Rob for a second because, Shannon, you touched on this before. Leasing the car for 1 month is one of the weirdest rewards I've heard in quite some time on Survivor.
Okay, well, I did want to talk about that in the Biostrat Variety Hour, but we'll move it up a bit. Okay, well, I looked it up, and the car seems to be worth, like, 300,000 Rand. So, like, that's, like, quite a lot of the prize money, like, probably too much for one challenge. And also, is he cursed? Like, this is something I've been tweeting about. I'm really interested. No one who's ever won the car has won the game. But what if you just won the car for a month? Which is, like, not even a year. Just 1 month of driving the car? Like, why? So once you get all your stuff in it, you're going to have to give it up.
It's so strange. Even me, I was like, oh, wait, no, what? Because I guess Mahindra is giving a car to fan favorite again, probably. Well, we know from the website. So, I mean, you could have it for a year, like a month.
Yeah, a month. You barely have time to, except you know what's going to happen. Rob's giving that car to Nathan 100%. And he says, like, look, buddy, drive it around for a month and then give it back to me.
It's definitely going to be branded Bromobile or something.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, like, he was going to end up buying it with his winnings. Like, once you have the car, is like a marketing thing. Like, that's why Mahindra is sponsoring the show. They know they're going to get one purchase out of the show when someone gets a month into that car, maybe won R1 million if they're Rob, and it's just like, you know what? I'll take it.
Or is the car so bad that you only want it for a month? That's
Ooh, also are they giving him a lemon? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, Mahindra, do better, I think, is the thing. Like, 1 month of the car was just... It's just
He's
not great.
Spending
I mean,
more
just,
time...
Rob have nothing.
If he makes the final three, he'll have spent more time out in Samoa than he would being able to drive this car, just to put things in perspective.
Yeah, my fiancé did say, though, that he thought that they made the car part of the immunity challenge so the jock couldn't steal it as a reward. But, like, would he even be stealing a month of the car? Like, definitely if you're winning the car... I mean, maybe not Jacques, because he wants to see his wife so badly.
How many times could you drive around your wife in that car, Jacques?
I know, but I wouldn't be stealing a month in the car. I'd rather have, like, a burger tomorrow, a veggie burger tomorrow, than, like, a month in one car. Why? I have a car now. I don't have to just transfer all my stuff and, like, get used to a new vehicle just to, like, give it away 3 weeks later. Like, I'm not into it.
It's a 4x4, probably, so it's heavy on petrol, and in South Africa, that's super expensive. There's a number of things that are problematic with this reward.
Look, we already did a lot against Biosgraph last week. We should probably just leave Mahindra alone, lest we, like, get Survivor South Africa canceled.
Throw another one onto the fire. It is interesting, though, because, I mean, I guess there was a point, you know, I have heard either Survivor contestants or Amazing Race contestants, when they win a car on the show, most of the time they end up selling the car, because to your point, and they're like, I already have a car and here's a new expensive car. Let me just try to sell it. So maybe they were trying to, maybe Mahindra, like, saw the writing on the wall, said, okay, I'm going to beat these players to their game. You get to lease it. You don't get to own it. So that way we can sort of pocket as much profit as we can and not have to worry about essentially giving away a car that's going to end up on the market sooner rather than later.
If you would just excuse me 1 second while I send a voice note to Vanner. Hey, Van, I'm busy with the podcast, and we're talking about the Mahindra car. Do you still have it? Did you sell it? Or are you still driving the car? And when he sends a response, I will share that with you.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe he hasn't leased it to you for a month. That's a valuable, valuable thing.
Well, to be fair, you did eliminate him from the jury, so maybe that's sort of like his last form of revenge.
We're good. We're good.
And now a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
And we are back. All right. Well, let's get to the chizzy after we've talked about everything from cars to the actual strategy to my cat. I love getting the cat mentions in there. Please do follow her on Instagram. But let's get to the chivy. It was a difficult week for me, especially because I was going on my entire story of what I think happened this episode. So take it away, Jacob Sega Weinstein and MC Color.
1, 2, 3.
All right, well, I'm going to say, yeah, as I said, it was difficult. And I basically had to rule people out of the chizzy for being actively bad. I could pretty much rule out everyone except the people I gave points to, and also Letitia. I didn't know what to do with Letitia, but I ruled out Steffi because I feel like she can't function with other human beings at the moment, and the laughing, I could not. Nicole's move with Kurbis still perplexes me, ruled that one out. As I said, Jacques, I did consider him, but I really feel like he just made several wrong moves that turned out really great for him. And, you know, like someone like Kelly Wentworth in Edge of Extinction, so many times she played her idol correctly and that was a good thing. And then other times, like the Joe vote, she got blindsided and she didn't play her idol and she got through on pure luck and she could have been sent home. And I feel like those things are really different. And that Jacques was the latter this week, so I couldn't reward him. Kubus as well, I couldn't give him an honorary point. Just couldn't pull the plan off. I thought there wasn't a lot of good stuff there. And then, yeah, Mike. Considered Mike because his social game is just so great, but the move, I think it's coming too late. And I have said before that, you know, sometimes it's not the perfect time. Like this vote, obviously he had the capacity to flip and he maybe even ran back to them at the very least, you know, didn't go with the flip because, you know, with his numbers that there would have been enough. But I just feel like, you know, sometimes it's not the perfect time, but it's a good time. I think this time at the final night could have been a good time and he didn't go with it. And I just have it in my mind that he was the one who ran back to them. It could have been Darrow, but I've decided through what I haven't seen that I really do feel like it was Mike based on the relationships that he has. So I'm going to give actually a vote to Darrow, one of the few people I haven't ruled out. Woo! And you know what? There's not a lot there. I have to say, there's not a lot there, but he did give up food, which for Darrow is a lot to quite a powerful player. He does have options, and I didn't see a lot of terribleness from him, so I'm giving him a point. I'm going to give a point to Rob, because I now understand the split vote, even if it was a bit paranoid or it was correct. Either way, I get it. His jury game is at least a little bit better than his allies, so I'm going to give him a point as well for maintaining the status quo. And then 2 points, if you've worked out who I haven't mentioned, to Maba. I said she really impressed me in this episode. I thought it was really just cool how she went against Rob for the advantage. She, again, wasn't doing anything terrible, kind of like everyone else. And I was impressed that she was in all of the major conversations about the vote. She's not even the decoy vote anymore. They switched that to Darrow. She's talking to, like, Nicole and Steffi. And she's, this point, these 2 points, actually, are to kind of signify how she's made her way up, you know, since Jeff left and kind of insulated herself into majority silently. It's not flashy. I think she would have made moves if she had numbers that she hasn't had. But I respect the way that she's kind of gotten in there. And if a flip does happen, she'll get, you know, even further. So I like where she's at the moment. But it was a tough week. So, Mike, who are you giving points to?
Well, let me continue on that Maba hype train. I'm going to throw her a point. My point majorly comes from actually the way she responded to Jacques' comment about her and Letitia at Tribal Council, which I feel like, again, if you're talking about sort of already playing to the jury, I feel like that was a big moment where Maba stood up for herself, but also really did a good job of explaining her game to the jury and simultaneously sort of shutting Jacques down as well, where I feel like Maba has been a bit disregarded in this game. I think that's a reason why to this point people are sort of like, oh yeah, we'll get rid of Maba down the line, let's keep her in the loop for now. But I think maybe she's starting to, you know, build a case for herself and start to vocalize her game. Whether or not that's a winning game, I'm not entirely sure, but I do give her kudos for, you know, like you said, facing off against Rob, speaking out against Jock, calling her game passive this episode. She's got some bite to her, even though she did not go for the bite to eat. I am going to give a point to Mike because I'm happy that we finally saw that he does have a plan in mind to go against the Saulas. Whether or not that's going to work is one thing, but I feel like that is a piece of information that we did not know before. And I think that helps validate some of his gameplay in our mind. Plus, even though it was very blatant, I actually really do like the move for him to give up the letter to Steffi, even though it was emotionally difficult. A, it plays into the mentality he vocalized in confessionals about how he wants to put off this mentality of, I don't want to win challenges so that way he doesn't come across as a threat. And B, he has endeared himself to arguably the most emotional player in the game. And I feel like it's going to be very tough for Steffi to want to turn on him after he was able to give that luxury to her. And you know what? I know we just heard from a Jacques hater this episode, but I'm going to give 2 points to Jacques here. Did he do stuff wrong? Absolutely. But the fact of the matter is, he survived an episode where he was pretty much vocalized to us as the main target for the majority of it. He was able to survive with an idol in pocket or around neck to basically guarantee himself another spot next time. He actually vocalizes the next time on that, like, hey, arguably you could all vote for me and then I single-handedly decide who gets to go home. I don't think that's going to be the case. But I know we didn't speak about this, actually, but I really liked what he did with the reward steal.
Yeah,
I'm happy that I really like the fact that he's now weaponizing it and has been using it to, you know, foster promises with people, because that's also going to say, like, if he puts across this idea that it's non-transferable, he's like, look, if you want to see your loved one, you have to bring me with you. And I really love what he did with that. I like the fact that he also did not approach multiple people with it. He only approached Kubis and Mike. And now that Kubis is gone, Mike is the only person that he has to deal with. And I think, especially considering what Mike just did, it was very observational on Jock's part to really, you know, take advantage of that. So is he in a pretty bad position? Absolutely. Did he do some things that I enjoyed this episode? Absolutely. So I agree, Shannon. It was a bit of a struggle to attribute, you know, points this week, because there were a vast majority of gameplay was not perfect, but I'm going to give 2 points to Jacques this week.
Look, he got lucky, or should we say Jockey? I don't know if that works. I'm not used to doing the Jacques puns like you. And I kind of like, it's like, I feel like all of his mistakes, like, kind of canceled each other out and, like, made this perfect situation for him. So, I mean,
we are talking to the person who talked up how lucky she was Jockey. In her final tribal council speech.
That's a new word. Well, yeah, I mean, definitely whether he was correct to play his idol has been the main argument, or one of the main arguments, as well as the split vote thing on the internet. So I'm glad we could kind of give either perspective. But John, who do you want to give your points to?
Yeah, I did find it hard in this episode, because some of the big people, like Rob, who's had a lot of focus on him over the last couple of episodes, sort of he wasn't as much in focus.
He did win like five things, though. Like, literally, he said that he wanted to get rid of Dante for the challenges, and he won in the next 2 days an advantage, food, a letter from home, a car for a month, and immunity. I was like, damn, you know what? You did it. Good job.
Yeah. But I have to, just because of Jacques and who he is, I have to give him the 3 points in my brain, just because of his ballsiness to sit there and not panic. And he's got that monkey on his shoulder of the previous screw up, and he's managed to sort of right himself and keep his nerve, and he was willing to go home for that move of buttoning up his shirt. You know what I mean? Like, that took some other kind of courage that I don't even have. So, I mean, yeah, exactly. Some steel whale balls. Do you know what I mean? So he would have to get my main points. But I also thought that Mike's, he would have to be my second Chizzy points too there, because his play of Steffi and the letters from home, even if he was giving it up because he knew he couldn't beat Steffi, his subtle and kind, again, manipulation of that situation for me shows such maturity in his gameplay and his understanding of the social game, and his understanding of, even if somebody's got to get voted out, they've got to go sit on the jury and make that decision. And those are the kind of decisions that can, at the end of the game, you know, be in the back of somebody's mind to say, you know what, I don't like Mike or the way he played the game, which is not in this case. But it could be those little deciding factors that could come up and be like, you know what, he gave me my letters when he didn't have to. And so I thought his social awareness and his manipulation of that situation was really smart on his point. And then I also have to agree with you guys. Mamba, for me, gets a vote because she has slowly and quietly been at the bottom of things. And, you know, people are not shy with telling you how they feel, even when the cameras are not there in front of you. The way that they treat you, the way that they speak to other people, the way that they run the ideas past other people and not you, is this way of telling you that they don't respect you as a game player. And so I guess we've seen her in tears, and we've seen her unsure, and we've seen her, you know, in a solid alliance and gone and stuck with the people she said she would stick with. And I think that she's been underplayed a lot. And even the comments from Nico about, you know, going up against Rob and, you know, did you think you could beat him? And just taking all of that on her chin and being like, you know what, I'm still here. My game is still valid and I'm still a player. And you've got to pay me the respect because I'm not sitting on the jury. And for me, I always back Mamba. She's been in my fantasy league team from day one. And I just thought she's one of these quiet players like Letitia who's going to go far. And at some point, she's going to be a crucial part of voting out the strength. So Steffi, however long she's got left in the game, Rob, they are going to rely on those players like Letitia and Mamba. And I cannot wait for those days.
Yeah, well, I think that means that I'm just doing math on the fly, which you know I hate, but I think that means Maba and Jacques do, you know, tie in this Chizzy win. And I'm just looking, I'm also trying to update the leaderboard in my mind. This is so hard. I think Rob now, I just took him up to 28 in the lead, but Jacques, hot on his heels, 27. And then if you take out all the people who've been voted out, Mike is next on 14. So really just like
a
two-horse race.
And then who's after him, Shannon?
It's Darrell, Mike. And I just gave him a point. So it's more Darrell.
So Shannon put out the Chizzy charts this past week, and I love the fact that many people pointed out that Darrell is in fourth place right now in terms of active players. Because
I mean, it's a
Darrell.
Far fourth place. Like, he's really far, but still.
But it's Darrell, and I love it.
Yeah. Nobody dislikes Darrell. He's like champagne, man. Nobody dislikes that.
Love that. Love that. But I want to also talk about things that we love, and that is the sponsors. And, you know, don't take what we did last week. You know, we still love Biostress. So let's get to the Biostress Variety Hour. Take it away, Jacob Sager Weinstein and the U.S. Army Blues.
And now it's the Biostress Variety Hour with your host, Shannon Gates. And also Mike Bloom.
Okay, well, we spoke about Mahindra's terrible reward. So I feel like we covered that. So the main two brands that I want to talk about are Biostrath and Cape Union Mart. I love their Twitter game this week. I do have a Biostrath game for you both, okay? If you're ready for it, I'm going to read out four tweets. Three of them are Biostrath, one of them is Cape Union Mart, and you have to decide, you know, you have to discover the Cape Union Mart tweet.
Sounds good. I'm trying to remember, Jean, did Cape Union Mart sponsor your season, or was it just Biostrath and Steers?
No, surprisingly enough, there were other sponsors besides Biostrath, but you guys have been drinking the bite because Cape Union Mart has been on from the beginning. You can see that Nico's wearing K-Way, which is their big brand of clothing. He's still wearing that. All of the crew, they all get a lot of kit from Cape Union Mart. They're not as like prominent on the series besides, I think, when they got the rain jackets, but they're definitely there. They're one of the core sponsors. Steers were there on my season, Biostrath, Mahindra, and we had Huawei as well, which was the phone sponsor, which we don't have this year.
Oh, well, yeah.
We hate you, Huawei.
I guess this season's a bunch of amateurs now because they don't have the phone.
Yeah. And you know what? People who shun the show after their sponsors, kind of like Probiflora, we have no time for you. You know what? And maybe we give really bad coverage to the sponsors, and maybe it's our fault. But you know what? Huawei, you're in my bad books for getting, you know, rid of your sponsorship. But Biostrath and Cape Union Mart, we're tweeting this week. And Jean, let's see if, you know, being on the show with the sponsors has given you an edge over Mike, even though Mike did have Biostrath a week ago, so he's feeling pretty focused too.
Don't remind me, please. I think it's still in my system.
Yeah, I know. I feel super energized. I felt really energized this entire week. It's been great. All right, here are the tweets. This one says, Nicole, you might want to keep the jury on your side for this one. Shrug emoji. I love that one because it's like, look, we might just be a brand, but we can even tell you're doing something wrong. So that was great. They said, we love it when the castaways are so confident about not being blindsided. And then a gif that said, like, ha, ha, ha. This one said, is this tribal council or is it a barbershop where we share all our stories? I don't know why barbershop, but love
it. I know Letitia called it trouble council. Should we call it barber council next time?
Yeah, that rolls off the tongue just as much. And this last one says, careful there, Jacques. Tricky one. This is the same person who blindsided her brother, tea drinking gif. So a lot of saltiness from the sponsors. Which one do you think is the Cape Union Mart tweet?
I mean, Biostrath is so spicy that it's very difficult to...
And in taste, spicy, yes. Mm.
Mm. A little chunky too, apparently, according to you. I'm going to say the barbershop one is Cape Union Mart.
What do you think, Mike?
I think... So, correct me if I'm wrong. So A and D both used emojis, correct?
D used a GIF. Number two used a GIF, and the first one used an emoji.
All right. I feel like it's going to be one of those three, because I feel like it's going to be a break from the trend. I'm going to say A is the Cape Union Mart tweet.
you're wrong. And I can't believe you could get something wrong after you had BioStrath a week ago. What a terrible endorsement for the product, unfortunately.
I mean, I think you could listen to our podcast last week and say what a terrible endorsement for the product as well.
I don't know how it people took that out of what we did. I literally said it's a lot, but it's worth it. And people were like, well, I'll never try it. And I was like, you should definitely be trying it. Were you reading the subtext of what I was saying? Definitely buy BioStrath. But Tape Union Mart, they definitely have a new social media guy, and I love it because it's just like one guy giving his personal thoughts with this like extremely casual commentary. Like he tweeted, if I were Letitia, I would stir things up a bit. He also spelt Letitia wrong. And also, so someone randomly tweeted, they didn't tag Tape Union Mart, they just used their Survivor Essay hashtag. And they said, why is Steffi obsessing about Jacques' idol? Who else has idols? And then they like quote tweeted at Tape Union Mart and were like, she's just trying to draw attention towards Jacques. It's not a bad tactic. And I love how, like, the brand is just, like, getting into casual conversations and discussions with people about, like, about the show. And it's just one guy. I love it.
So I didn't have the right answer. Did John?
Yeah, John did. Oh, sorry, John. Good job. You win.
Yay! Do I want a bottle of BioStrath? I still have one from last year. So mine probably is more chunky than the one that you tried.
God, I can mail it back to you.
Oh, God.
Also, BioStrath did tweet saying, so much emotion in tonight's episode. Stand a chance to win a prize if you can remember how many people shed tears today. What a savage competition.
Wow. Sure. It's like a change of the CBS Survivor account. I feel like there was something with like Gabby where they're like, how many times did Gabby cry during the season? Or like, what time did she not cry? So I guess they're being similarly shady, but did anyone win the prize?
I mean, I didn't see it tweeted out, but I assume so. I just like the idea of BioStrath just kind of like writing down how many people cried in this like answer for their competition. That's like next level savage.
I would watch a show where they take all this social media managers and put them on an island and then see what happens. But they would have to include Stefan Lombard, who is also savage on Twitter during the show. So yeah, I would watch that.
Yeah, Survivor sponsors and mean tweeters. I love that, and I would definitely watch it. You know, Cape Union Mart also giving away like R1,000 just during the episode. They're like, oh, if you can tell us who's gonna go home, we'll pick it out in a random draw who gets R1,000. I'm like, how are you giving out better prizes than Mahindra literally gave out in this challenge? Like, you're giving it out on social media and it's better than what's on the show.
That's why I think, you know, you were saying they were a bit too buddy-buddy, but I think the claws are finally starting to come out in this post-merge sponsor game, Shannon.
Yeah, I love to see it. But we do have a couple of questions that we didn't get to in this episode. I think we definitely did answer a lot. Barbecue Ice on Twitter asked, does anyone else think a Nicole and Steffi final two will be the greatest ending to this already crazy season?
No, the correct answer is Jean and Tom at the end of Survivor South Africa Philippines. Thank you very much.
I want to see Doral, Steffi, Nicole, because that's a Doral win, and that's what I'm personally wanting.
You just want to see Doral say more words. But Steffi, Nicole would be, I mean, just flames versus fire. A big flames versus ice, because they call Nicole the ice queen and Steffi has got a temper and she just says no filter. So to me, that would be like calm, cool ice queen pageant, Mrs. S.A. Versus Steffi, who's just guns blazing. So I would watch that.
Well, yeah. I love that you basically called the finale A Song of Ice and Fire, Jean. And to that, I will say,
good analogy. Thank
you, Jacques. Oh my God. I love that it took almost 2 hours to get it, but it was as good as I wanted it to be. Jacques he plays podcaster out there too much. He analyzes his own moves. He ranks the analogies. Please leave the stuff to us, Jacques. Okay. Like, we're the ones on the podcast doing that.
To be fair, let's listen to the source material for a hot second to listen to Kubis's analogy as he's trying to literally dance his way through it.
It's been 3 tribal councils where I get back to camp and I'm like, WTF just happened. So, you know, obviously I'm not reading the right script before we come here always. So I'm just saying.
I like it.
No, that's such a bad analogy. We decide what's a good analogy and now we have the sound drop to do it. That's great. We really did answer most of these questions. I'll ask one last one, which does also pertain to Steffi and Nicole. Jason Gates asks, what can someone like Steffi and Nicole do now that the jury is clearly already against them? Is it possible to change the jury's perspective, or are they doomed to being losing finalists? This is an interesting one, because I think we're both kind of seeing that those two people, I mean, I guess unless they're against each other in a final two, might be kind of drawing dead. And that's not something you want when you have, like, you know, so much left to play in the game. So I wonder if there is something that, you know, they can do.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would love to hear from John's perspective, because I think you were somebody who certainly garnered a reputation with the jury that I wonder, you know, is it impossible to overcome that? It's tough because Stephanie Nicole's reputation is based on how they fundamentally think about the morals of the game. Like, I think if they vocalize, like, hey, I thought this one thing and now I don't anymore, so now I have to get rid of you, Rob, maybe that'll turn their opinion. But I feel like no matter what they do, they're going to get to the end and people are going to call them out on, you know, the way that they're trying to go through this game with the honor and loyalty after making several moves that are anything but.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's not the fact that they did or did not make moves. It's you mentioned it earlier. It's how they own those moves or lack thereof. And I think I made that mistake where you try and be too politically correct. And I didn't say the things that I should have said. And they can be swayed, but the both of them would have to strategize and take Rob out. Then they would have to take Mike out and Jacques. They would have to do like these big moves and sit at the end against somebody like Marba or Letitia, who have the perception of riding coattails. They would have to make huge moves now, and then they would have to go into tribal council and not attack the jury because the jury's going to come at them with bitter all over them. And they're going to have to manage how the jury is attacking them, because that is also what threw me. I wasn't expecting the current format of Survivor where people just get up and they don't get up and have a question or a comment. They have this open discussion. I was never ready for that. I was never ready for 3 hours of vitriol to be spewed at me. And if they can handle not retaliating and not fighting and not picking fights and not defending themselves and owning what the jury is coming with their own reality and their own view on things. And if they can say, geez, I hear you and I never thought of it that way, but you're right, I did do that, and the outcome was you being voted out. It all depends on how they can answer those pageant questions.
Mm.
Yeah, well, you would think for Nicole that might be a good thing, but they called her nauseating. Like, literally, it's a hard one to turn around. But that's all the questions that we have. We have got to the end of the podcast. I wonder what the hashtag is, because I have 4 options and 3 of them are Jacques puns. I had Jockey, Jocking, and Jocks. I don't even remember what these things are, but they're Jacques puns. But I do want to go with hashtag bloomed it up, which is something you coined, Mike, as a term for getting naked. Why you would do that to your own name, I don't know, but it's something you did roughly 2 hours ago, and now it's the hashtag.
Listen, you live with the decisions you make, both in the game and on podcasting, so I'm promptly going to do this, button up my top, and walk gently into that good night.
Yeah, and we still don't know what was going on besides the top, which is unfortunate. But John, thank you so much for staying beyond that first part of the podcast for the rest of the podcast. I know you've been doing some really cool stuff on Instagram talking about the show, so where can everyone find what you're doing?
Yeah, I do every Sunday. We have a repeat on Sunday afternoon on Mnet. And at around 7:30, 7 o'clock, somewhere there on Sundays, I'll do an Insta Live where I'll be chatting and taking questions from people. And it's quite cool because LaRue often is there. Some of the crew, camera people tune in. Some of the contestants try and sneak in without being noticed. So it's quite a cool interactive thing. People often ask for a personal account of how something played out. So that's always fun. And then I do upload those onto YouTube and people can just search my name, Jean Michel, which J-E-A-N-N-E Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L on YouTube. And they'll find all the previous recaps and on Instagram at Jean Michel 1983.
Awesome. Well, Mike, what do you have going on in the podcast world?
Working on some Big Brother exit press now that the jury has begun, and there was a very cathartic exit this week. So be sure to check all that out on parade.com. Doing some stuff with Josh Wigler. We just did a recap of the hit 1980s children's film, The Neverending Story, which is really interesting on a rewatch as an adult. And we have some other fun stuff coming out. Have a couple of fun announcements coming out this week in particular. And I have a plug for one more podcast, but I will not Bogart it. So I will throw it back to Shannon.
Okay, great. I love when you give me the opportunity to plug the many podcasts that we do. We'll always follow Mike at A Mike Bloom Type. Follow me at Shannon Gates. I had the great Mike Bloom on the Australian Survivor podcast.
We had
a lot of fun with that, I think, you know, and in classic Mike and Shannon fashion, we were, you know, thinking, is Goose Juice people? Would that something we thought about Sears before? I think we have just a lot of conspiracy theories about what food is people. I don't know why we tend to go down that road. We said the word balls a lot. This is just my life. Next week, we have Jackie Glazier, the, you know, poker player / Rubik's Cube champion, you know, to talk about the next three episodes this week. Three episodes a week. It is a lot. I also want to plug that I was on ABC Live National Radio in Australia, a show called Stop Everything, to talk about the cultural phenomenon that is Survivor, you know, kind of, you know, in Australia and globally as well. Talk about the fandom, which was a really, really cool experience. I mean, it's pertinent to have you on, John, as a radio host. This was the first time I had ever done live radio, which was very, very fun. I'm jealous of your job. That's a very fun thing to do. But you can catch it now as a podcast on the Stop Everything podcast and, you know, the Apple Podcast app. Also online, which I've linked to on my Twitter, or the ABC Listen app. So that was the August 9 episode. And yeah, that was a really fun thing.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to listen yesterday, and I thought you did a fantastic job representing the community. You even made a Wandoff reference to underline just how committed this community is. But yeah, it was super interesting. I think you guys, it also came from two different perspectives. You know, one of the hosts, I think, was either a casual or didn't really watch the show. The other one had sort of left US Survivor after 10 seasons and then sort of came back into it with the Australian version. So it was really cool to see you sort of get into it, and especially some of the larger, I'd say more optic issues that sometimes occur on Australian Survivor, and especially why this franchise has still kept going. You did a fantastic job vocalizing that also. I highly recommend everyone literally stop everything and tune in to Stop Everything to check out what Shannon had to say.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's definitely a 15-minute segment, so I hope you guys will check it out. But never forget the time I talked about Edgic on national radio. Like, this is truly my identity now. I can't come back from this.
That's awesome. Also, I just want to give you an update. Vanna just WhatsApp me back. He says, it's a great car, the Mahindra XUV 500 and the XUV 300. Literally just sold mine to a generous buyer.
It's a great car and it's gone from my possession.
I mean, it's a year later, so he's done pretty well.
That is pretty good.
That's good. Yeah, that's good that he had it for 12 times longer than Rob's going to have his.
And he made money off it. He did a lot better than Rob.
Yeah, he did.
Oh my God. I can't believe they gave the car for a month. Poor Survivor South Africa. I love it so much. And next week, we'll have the great Leona Boris joining us to talk about this season. So that's super fun because she did, obviously, you know, the preseason podcast with me. So I want to see how wrong we were about a lot of these things now that we will be 14 weeks into the season, people, and so much more to go.
I am so excited. Listen, I love Leona. We'll actually be getting together to do a Big Brother B&B this week as well. I'm very excited to talk with her about the season. I'm also said I will like sign off here by memorializing Kubis for a second because I think he's going to be amazing on the jury. I mean, this is a guy who, as we remember, brought us...
We beat your ass.
So I feel like he's going to provide a lot of great facial reactions and just general... I don't know, throwing his hands up like Dante did in response to him going. So while it stinks to lose him in the game, because I thought he did have some pretty solid footing up until a few weeks ago, and he was just a fantastic character, I'm looking forward to seeing that fantastic character on the jury and talking about it along with all the other, you know, it seems like Jacques is sort of now doing his, we're now going to see Jacques' last stand next week, and I'm excited to break that down with Leona.
Definitely. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on with us. It was so great to finally talk to you. I have not gotten over the fact that Mike got to do your fantastic deep dive, even though, you know, that's fine. He claimed it. You know, I still love Mike, but I've been holding it against him. But now I feel like I can kind of release some of that negative energy and that I've been able to podcast with you as well.
And you just had 2 hours of your life.
Yeah.
Dedicated, John, in your headphones.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. I just feel sorry for you. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast with us. It was awesome to have you. You guys can subscribe to the International Survivor Hapups feed so you never miss podcasts like this. But thank you again, Jean. Thank you to you, Mike. Thanks to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. We will see you next week with Liana. Bye.